Podcast meeting brilliant minds and looking at the world around them. How do they 360 themselves and 360 the world? Jamie Neal, the host, asks many questions about their mindset and how they fundamentally operate their world and the world around them. Hello and welcome back to 360 Yourself. I hope you're having a beautiful morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you are in the world, New York, LA, London. Our audiences are getting bigger and better. It's so beautiful. And we love when you communicate with us. Please do rate our Instagram and our podcast on all the social media outlets and platforms. We love when you communicate with us, especially on Apple Podcasts. If you can leave a feedback and everything, that would be amazing. So what's going on in the world? I mean, COVID's happening. What's happening next week? I think on the 20th, I think Donald Trump is leaving the office and Biden's taking over. I mean, everything is happening in the world at the moment, and it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, there's so much time that we can have by ourselves at the moment, because obviously in London, where most people are happening at the moment. I mean, I'm in Devon at the moment. I was in London. But a lot of people are in this lockdown moment. I know in LA, it's also the same thing as well. So we got so much time to reflect, time to see what we want to do as well. And I think use your time wisely, read, educate yourself, go for loads of runs, because when we ever, probably never, we'll never have a situation like this where we have COVID. Maybe not in my lifetime, maybe in your lifetime. I don't know who's listening, what ages you are, but hopefully we won't. And so you need to treasure this moment, treasure this time. If you're staying with your friends, with your family, have this moment to really, really sink into the present and don't think about the future too much and don't think about the past, because it will just confuse your brain. So moving forward, I do want to just basically have a round of applause for this gentleman. I mean, he's a two-time Oscar-nominated producer for In the Bedroom and Lost in Translation. I mean, I can't believe he's on the podcast, so I'm very, very excited to talk to him and see how his mind works. I want to introduce Ross. How are you doing, Ross?
I'm doing great, Jamie. Hello from New York. And I got to say, you are like... I was in this kind of headspace of, oh, I have so much work to do. And that was really inspiring. You're so right. You're so right. Because we can, you know, I've started to do a thing where in my home office, where I leave my phone and my laptop in my home office when I go out, like at the end of the day, because I found that I didn't take any time to reflect. I didn't take any time to do something that was just for me. Mm-hmm. I figured, well, I'm here. This is my home. It's also my office. I'm just going to work. And I realized that I was working insane amounts of hours just because I was in lockdown.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because we're so confused about what is work and what is play, or like your leisure time, because some people just roll out of bed, and I'm also a culprit of that as well. Sometimes I roll out of bed and I'll just make a coffee or tea and then go straight to my computer rather than just have an hour to myself, because usually you would have an hour or 2 hours if you're traveling to work, but now we're having more time to spend with our friends and family because we're not traveling. But then sometimes that means an extra 2 hours working rather than that time that you used to travel to work. Use that time to just have a moment of like stillness and just to connect with your family or to connect with yourself and just have a bit of a meditative morning.
Yeah. It's important.
Yeah. It's so, so important. So I just think that balance is really, okay. Again, balance is really important in life. So what I want to talk about is, how did it all start with you? Do you come from a family of like producers or filmmakers or anything like that? Because you've done such an amazing, amazing career, and I'd love to know where it all started.
Thank you. That's very kind. It started oddly. I wanted to, since I was a little kid, seeing things on the big screen like Raiders of the Lost Ark, I knew I wanted to do that. I wanted to make people feel the way that I felt sitting in the chair in the movie theater. And as I became a teenager, I was definitely, I mean, I was sneaking into films that were for, you know, 18 and older, to see like Tim Roth play Vincent Van Gogh. I remember being, I must have been 15 or something, to see Martin Scorsese do The Last Temptation of Christ, which was a very controversial movie in the US, and you know, crossing through a picket line and just starting to learn the impact that speaking to an audience through a film can have. And I was also quite interested in radio, and the only job I could get in radio was on a Christian rock station, which I cast no aspersions toward, but I'm Jewish. And they just kind of said, you know, maybe we can tweak your last name a little bit. And so when I graduated to a kind of a big commercial station, I felt I was at a real crossroads and having a midlife crisis at 20. And it was either going to be make movies or stay the course and stay in radio. And I opted to drop out of film school. Well, I didn't opt to drop out of film school. I couldn't afford film school. My family is, they're absolutely wonderful, but, you know, we are not a family of means. We don't have, you know, money for generations. My parents very much live paycheck to paycheck. And I said to them, I'm going to get in that beat up Hyundai and drive 3,000 miles to California, and I'm going to try to make movies. And you could see the sense of panic on my parents' faces.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But they were so supportive, and my brother was like, I think my parents thought, okay, well, at least one of the kids turned out, because my brother had gone to undergraduate school at Stanford. Mm-hmm. Then he worked for President Bill Clinton's Department of Justice, and then he went to Yale Law School.
Oh, wow. So, like, hey.
So you have that, which is like an A++++ resume, and then you have me, the dropout. And I think my parents were like, all right, one out of two is not bad.
I mean, he must be very, very academic.
My brother?
Yeah.
In a sense, but what I think is so great is, like, you know, I don't know if they in the UK they have these, if they have standardized testing, but it's something really awful, I think, in the US. The they call it the SAT, the standard.
SAT. Yeah, we have I think GCSEs is your equivalent to SATs.
And it's very, very, it's been proven many times that certainly, you know, there are people of color, people from certain socioeconomic backgrounds, that the test is not really designed for them to thrive. Mm-hmm. And my brother is someone who was and is utterly brilliant. I mean, he is brilliant. But when it came to those tests where you fill in the little dot with a pencil on a multiple choice question for 3 hours, he was in an absolute panic. He froze up.
Wow.
And he didn't do well. And what I loved about him getting into Stanford, which is one of the hardest schools in the country to get into, was that they don't put really any value on that test. Mm-hmm. They put much more of a value on sort of who you are as a rounded human being.
Yeah, because also like the test, you could be terrible at tests, and we all learn very differently as well.
Absolutely. And he's terrible at tests, but he's brilliant, as is evidenced by the career he went on to. He was also, he was an assistant district attorney for our new vice president, Kamala Harris.
Oh, wow. Okay. Amazing.
Yeah. So he was the good kid.
Yeah. I'm sure your parents are very proud of you because you've achieved a lot. But it also goes back to, I've always believed, it doesn't matter where you go, even if it's Stanford, Yale, or like RADA or anything, if you have a certain mindset, then you will get on. But also as well, it depends on the person. I mean, we were talking earlier about dropouts. Like, there's so many people like Steve Jobs and these other brilliant people who did drop out early, but also became successful.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to do with your... Some people have a really strong ability to be stimulated by what's out there in the world and to be like a sponge and sort of almost by osmosis, just being a certain place at a certain time, they are constantly learning. That is very much me. But if you stick me in a classroom with a regimented hour that I am designated during that hour to learn, I'm not the best guy for it. Mm. I want to see, you know, I mean, even just an example of like a friend, I don't know anything about gardening. I live in New York City and Central Park is very close, but I certainly don't garden there. But just one summer I was with a friend who's a landscape designer. He's really an artist. And I learned so much watching him. I was blown away. I was so excited. He's like, why is this exciting to you? I was like, because watching someone at the top of their game, whether or not they are fixing a car engine, teaching, you know, calculus, you know, making a film, working as a nurse, when someone's really in command of what they do and they have built themselves to be that person, it's very exciting to me. So like, it was the same thing for film for me. I certainly learned quite a bit in my 2 years out of four about, you know, things like the French New Wave and really great historical academic aspects of filmmaking. What I didn't learn was what you're supposed to do when you get out of school. And what if you're someone with no money and no connections? Like, is it available to someone like me? You know, and I, even my parents, I adore them, but they said, you know, we don't know Hollywood. We don't even know anybody.
Yeah, like
you can say hello to.
It's the same thing for my family as well. Exactly the same as my family. But you just kind of grit and you got to make the connections. You got to go out there and say hello.
Yeah, and I moved into $175 a month apartment rental. My car, not even apartment, room rental, in LA.
I mean, that's very cheap. How did you find that, firstly?
Well, it was a while ago, but it was, when I tell you, this was, my mom came to visit and she was beyond horrified. She was like, I don't understand. Where's the rest of it? You live in this room? And I was like, oh, you just have to climb over the sofa bed to get to the bathroom and the coffee maker is right past it.
Oh, wow.
And my mom was like, oh my God, I don't even want to know this.
LA lifestyle.
Yeah, very glamorous. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, at the time it was about faxing resumes. Mm-hmm. And I just without knowing anybody, I picked up Variety, which, you know, used to be in print. And in the back, they had a list of films in production. And I sent, I wish I had a copy of it. I just remember my resume was so ridiculous because I hadn't done anything. I made cheesesteak sandwiches outside of Philadelphia when I was 16. I had a Christian radio show. And then I had a show on a rock station. Mm. And I had nothing else.
I mean, they must have saw something though, because obviously you only had a small amount of credits, but they must have saw something for you to get onto Reservoir Dogs.
Well, first of all, Reservoir Dogs was not Reservoir Dogs at the time. Mm. It was just another low budget movie, you know, another kind of, you know, okay, here we go. Here's a low budget movie with an unknown director being made for like $1 million. Like it wasn't like other people in the industry would not have said at the time, oh my gosh, I can't believe you got on Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
They would probably say, can't you get on something with a bigger budget? Because I got paid $50 per week.
Wow. Okay.
And when I called my mom, I said, Mom, I got a job. I'm going to be on a movie set. She said, what does it pay? I said, $50 a week. And my mom said, $50 an hour? That's a lot. And I said, no, it's not only is it a week, but it's a 6-day week. My mom was like, I don't even know how to respond to that. It's like 4 cents an hour.
Yeah, but the way you got to look at it is that you're on set, you're learning. And that's, I mean, it's
possible. Yeah, how would I have ever, I mean, it was one of the most remarkable experiences. I did not know what I was doing. I was a grip, which is kind of the non-electrical side of lighting. So putting shadows on people's faces and things like that. I didn't know anything. And this kind of salty crew from LA, you know, who's like, who's this clown, this director? He's very big and loud and works at a video store. And I wasn't cynical like they were. I was just, you know, I've always said like genuine, not manufactured, but genuine enthusiasm and passion that come from the pit of your stomach can outdo any degree that exists in the world.
Mm-mm. Amen.
And I really truly believe that. I also was looking back because I happened to find a picture from Reservoir Dogs, which shocked me. And I realized that somebody was putting together my bio for something, and I had sort of, you know, I've been to a lot of public things, but I strongly prefer to be behind the scenes. You know, like it's great to go to a movie premiere and it's great to go to a film festival, but the part that I love is making it. Mm. I don't really love the social aspect of it.
Yeah.
And what I realized was that every time somebody said no to me and was very early on, I learned that this business is 99%, no exaggeration, all out rejection.
Mm, it is.
And it is extremely difficult to not personalize it.
So, how did you come across that mindset to know that you were going to get a lot of rejections, but not listen to them? How did you build up the kind of the strength in your mind?
To be completely honest with you, it took me years and years to get relatively confident. And it's something I'm still working on.
Mm.
You know, it's something that it's still evolving for me, which is just that, you know, like I always say to people, you know, there's a big thing in our culture and I'm not going to say who the actor is, but an Academy Award-winning actor said to me, you know, there's a difference between an actor and a star. I'm not a star, I'm an actor. And I thought about that a lot. And what he was basically saying to me is, you know, with Instagram, and there's all these great things about social media, but people think that they start to think less of that acting is a craft and more that acting is being seen on a red carpet somewhere.
But it's part of the, it's sort of part of the job though, isn't it? It's like you do the job, but then you've got to do the promotion. You've got to do the tours. But I think what people do forget is that you're there for the craft, the acting. That's the main thing. If you're not a good actor, then the rest of it won't follow.
Yeah. And so you have a friend of mine who lost his job because of COVID, his company laid off a lot of people. He said, you know, I'm getting really upset because it's been 20 years since I looked for a job. And I'm looking at all these jobs. And you know what jobs are available? You know, must be excellent. Must have a masterful command of social
media.
Must understand how to create and advise an influencer. And I think that when it comes to our business, it's great when you have a movie coming out and you can tweet it to everybody and get people talking about it. The downside, I think, is that people, you know, the best actors in the world make it look like it's the easiest thing in the world.
Yeah, of course.
And since you're in the UK, you may especially appreciate this, but a truly wonderful and Oscar-nominated actor I've worked with twice came to set one day on a film I was making, and he was the only one who didn't look at sides, and sides are basically just the dialogue for all the scenes that day. Mm-hmm. And it's just a little reference sheet for the actor in case they forget their lines or whatever. Mm-hmm. I had never in more than 25 years an actor not holding their sides and their lines until the very last minute. This British actor came onto the set with no papers and no script. And we were doing, it was a huge day, like six scenes, shooting completely out of order, a couple of very emotional, very important scenes. And I said, where are your sides? He said, you know, I came up in London in the theater, and, you know, it was not about being famous. It was about mastering your craft. And the least I can do
is learn your lines.
Is know my lines.
Is that way? That's what you would think, though. Like when people go on to set and when they go into a job before, like you have the rehearsal, and then when people go onto the theatre for lighting and all that sort of thing, they only should know their lines. So when you start going to shoot, should you not look? You know your lines. Is the same thing as theatre.
Yes, that's an excellent assumption. That is unfortunately not the case.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
I just loved, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, this is a guy who cares deeply about, you know, for him, I said, why do you make movies? I always ask people this, you know. It's like my dumb party trick question. Why do you make movies? And he said to me an answer that I've heard before from others. He said, well, I want to convey to the audience our shared humanity. Even when I'm playing evil or bad or corrupt or insensitive, or I am, you know, tapping into the human condition, and I'm letting people in the audience know that what they felt and experienced, I felt and experienced too. And I thought, that's really incredible. And then, you know, I've had a couple of disheartening meetings with, certainly not a blanket statement about younger actors, but a couple of younger actors that it was very clear from the strategic, you know, selfies to me having to say, you can't take pictures of the set, you know, it was very clear that for that, for those individuals, it was about, it was being a celebrity for the sake of being a celebrity. It wasn't, you are a celebrity because you are a brilliant performer.
Yes. Yeah. And that looks at like influencers, and I mean, there's many documentaries about what influencers are now, and are you an influence just to be an influence, or are you an influence because you are very good at what you do?
Right. That's absolutely the case, you know. And I'm not old.
Definitely.
I go to, you know, I go to meetings, and it's a weird thing. This is my analogy. When things started to switch from film to digital, I was very excited by that, because I was that kid in film school who didn't have parents who could give him, you know, $30,000 to go buy film equipment and film, you know. And so when they had these, you know, video cameras that were affordable, I thought, well, it doesn't look nearly as nice as film. This is back in the day. But hey, a guy like me from Philadelphia can afford it, so I can tell a story. And the one thing that I would say is the real downside to being able to really construct a narrative and tell a compelling story is that because it's so easy, relatively speaking, to shoot, that in fact you could make a full feature length movie that will play in a movie theater on an iPhone. People are paying less attention to the script. But when you were about to plunk down a big wad of cash that represented all of your savings just to buy film stock, you killed yourself to make sure the script was worth that.
For sure, yeah.
You know, and that's why I think people, the most kind of Zen people that I've met, the people who are really at peace with what they do and who they are, in terms of their professional lives, they have really mastered, they've taken a craft, and you know, that craft could be venture capitalism. I mean, it doesn't have to be art, you know.
Yeah.
But they've decided to become a master of that craft. You know, there's a town in, I mean, this is the kind of thing that would bore most people, but like there's a town in Japan that I think is a couple hundred miles from Tokyo, but I've read about it. And the entire town makes eyeglasses. And they're not made in factories. They're made one by one, by hand, acetate, some kind of wheel thing, some kind. And I saw a thing on it, a special on it, and I was mesmerized, because the pride in the quality of the work was more important than the income, than the fact that they were 80 years old and had been doing it for 75 years. The most important thing was that every individual glass, you know, piece of glasses or set of glasses that they made was their own form of perfection, is something that is very appealing to me. So that when I'm making a movie, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on the actors or the people that are, you know, outward facing to the public. But boy, when I watch a craftsperson doing, whether it's lighting or wardrobe or whatever it is their particular thing that they are passionate about, they are driven about, and they have gotten their head to the place where they have mastered it, it's so exciting to me.
And something we were talking about earlier, like way earlier, was about mistakes and growing up, and we talk about age and about developing, and I would say I would never want to relive my early 20s. And yeah, you've had such an amazing diverse career of EPing so many brilliant films, especially with Taking Chances with Kevin Bacon. What would be the things that what would be the things you learn when you were younger that you'd now take into when you're older now, and the things that you wouldn't do again?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I mean, I don't know what the feeling is there in the UK, although I made a movie in the UK last year with Jamie Dornan and Peter Dinklage called My Dinner with Hervé. And I loved shooting in the UK so much. It was much less cynical and jaded. And there was so much enthusiasm on the set. But one, I would say, honestly, therapy. I'm a big believer in therapy, and I used to be afraid of it because my mom was a little afraid of it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is acknowledging that something is wrong. Mm-hmm. And actually, by going to therapy, I was acknowledging that something was right with me. And I came to a place in 2009 where I had made some movies that had, you know, gotten some affection from audiences and critics and whatnot. And I had done a movie for HBO called The Laramie Project, and I produced that. And they asked me to come and be a producer on this film, Taking Chance. And I said, you know, I don't want to do anything about the Iraq war. It's been done. I know where I stand. And they said, trust us. You know, this is not what you think it is. And I read the short story, which is really a journal on which it was based. And I did the most ridiculous, I mean, even when I think about it, I cringe. I went in for a meeting the next day, and the, you know, honchos at HBO thought they were meeting me about producing the movie. And I said, I'd like to write it. And what I didn't tell them is that I'd want to direct it. And they said, you want to write it? What do you have to show? I said, I wouldn't show you any scripts that I have. They're just doodles. But I can tell you that this story got into my bloodstream. I cannot shake it. And I don't want to look back. You may say no. You may say, you know, you're not a director. Or you're not a writer. But I didn't want to be 65 or 70 years old and look in the rearview mirror and say, man, I didn't even try.
Exactly that.
And that is really probably my biggest guiding principle, which is that when I was looking at for this bio thing, my career, I realized I never put this together, that I had never, literally without exception, had never had a single success without taking a potentially career-killing risk. Without risking finances, risking sleep, risking reputation. I even had an agent who said to me, listen, you're like, you know, like a really beloved producer now. If you go make this movie and you fall on your face, you know, what are you going to do? And I remember telling that to my therapist. My therapist said, listen, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in the building, but if you listen to that crap, you're crazy.
Exactly, yeah.
And she said, are you going to live in fear? Or are you going to say, well, I'm going to try it because it's in my blood and it's my passion, and I may fail.
Mm. But failing is good, though. It's good to know how to fail well. That's important in our life, and to have a risk as well, and to also look back when you're 65 and go, I made that decision to speak up and say, I want to direct and write it and EP it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, things I really wished someone had guided me at the very beginning of my career and told me, like, people are going to be rude to you. They're not just going to reject you. They're going to close the door in your face.
Mm-mm.
They're not going to sugarcoat it. You know, I wish I had the tools to not go home and be depressed for 2 weeks, you know? And I did a lot of that where I'd get so excited and think I had something when I was, you know, 22 or 23, and then I didn't get it, and I would just beat myself up really badly.
Yeah, rather than actually just going, okay, that's a no, move on to the next one. Okay, it's not for me in the universe.
But another example, I mean, these examples were hitting me in the face left and right, and I wasn't seeing them, was the first film. I was very lucky to be nominated for 2 Oscars. Mm. And the first film I was nominated for was called In the Bedroom,
mm-hmm.
With Tom Wilkinson, Marissa Tomei, Sissy Spacek. And we made that movie for under $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, the distributor and the people who were going to put it out in the world kind of thought, well, it's not a lot of money, but so we'll take a risk on it. But but here's what people don't know. Every single company you can imagine, plus like going to dentists, to doctors, and anybody wealthy, everyone said no to In the Bedroom. And we actually had a meal where we said, well, if we don't get a yes by the end of the week, it's time to pour whiskey on the grave. Well, we got a yes, and we got literally only one yes and probably 100 no's.
That's what you need.
And with that one yes, we made a $1.9 million movie that ended up with 5 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture. 3 of the actors were nominated, and the film made, you know, something like $50 million in the U.S. Alone. And I just thought to myself, what if we had listened to all of those people who said, it's a kind of a slow, depressing art movie, you know, nobody's going to want to see this. All I knew was in my gut, not based on any kind of genius. I don't have any of that. I just have a gut reaction. And my gut was telling me this was one of the most beautiful pieces of writing I had ever read. And I had to make this movie. And
sometimes you just know, though. Sometimes you just know, and you just have to keep going until it's made.
That's right.
Mm. It's just really, really important to listen to your gut, though, isn't it? I mean, you obviously knew it had to be made. And I think it's that resistance and that persistence in our industry that this is what happens when successful people make it. It's because they were so persistent. They were like, even if I get 99 no's, that one yes, that's all I need.
You only need one yes. And if there's somebody out there that gets it, and 99 people out of 100 tell you, this is not good. It's not funny. It's not dramatic. It's not. And the one person says, you know what? This broke me. I stayed up and I cried when I read it.
Mm.
And that person is willing to go for it. The other 99, you know, I mean, you know, Lost in Translation was also a movie that I don't think people were looking, you know, as harshly on it as In the Bedroom. But, you know, people were like, oh, this is a small art movie. It'll have a nice little art run and it won't really have an impact on people, but, you know, it'll do fine. Nobody had high expectations.
And it did so well.
All the people around us, you know, and I remember that the hotel that the film takes place in, the Park Hyatt in Tokyo, I was practically in tears with the general manager. And he said, look, this is a built-in hotel. We're talking about billions of dollars to build a hotel like this. You know, why would we do some little movie here that is not going to do anything for us?
Mm-hmm.
And I was just trying to come up with anything that I could. And I said, but the publicity for the hotel is going to be amazing. And they were like, oh, come on. It's a low budget independent movie. And they finally said yes, with a lot of restrictions. And you can go there now and take a Lost in Translation tour.
And that's amazing. I mean, what brilliant advertising and marketing for them.
You know, at the time, they were just like, this is just a little nothing. It's probably not even going to come out, you know. And so, you know, I think it's very important to listen to people. But also, I think that the one word that I think that is, for me, I was lucky. There are three directors I worked with that had massive influences on me. First being Quentin Tarantino. The second kind of major director that I worked for 3.5 years was the late, great Sidney Pollack. And I used to say, corner him in the lunchroom and say, can I ask you about 3 Days of the Condor and the Way We Were, you know? And he was very charmed by that. You know, sometimes he would say, I don't have time now, kid, you know? But the thing that, you know, he taught me was that, like, you should listen to people to an extent. But when they are so adamantly going against what your gut is telling you, at the very least, you should take a pause. And you should say, okay, I may not be an expert, I may not have a track record, but there's something here that I can't let go of.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are times where I listened to my gut and, or a therapist or both, and there are times that I didn't listen to my gut, and every time I took the safer route, I ended up feeling like what I was doing was very mediocre.
Which is usually what happens, though. If you just go the safe route, you're not actually growing, you're not actually pushing in, you don't really want to do that.
That's right.
And so as we kind of finalize the podcast, what we always do at the end, we like to do a give back to our audience. I mean, we've touched upon so many different subjects and what you have learned from your younger years, but is there any like books or quotes or any other pieces of advice from directors or people that you've met that you give back to our audience?
Well, I love a quote that that Quentin says. I think the first time he was interviewed and said, you know, they said to him, so he is like hot director, this new hot director. Did you go to film school? And he just looked at them and went, I didn't go to film school. I went to films. And it was like, it was to me, that's really profound and doesn't actually in any way is not exclusive to the film business. You know, it was his way of saying, you don't have to be rich. You don't have to be connected. You don't have to be from, you know, a famous family. You can be a nobody from nowhereville and become one of the most important filmmakers ever to you know, certainly one of the most important filmmakers of our time. You know, you know, there are all sorts of quotes I'm actually looking at. It's funny that you mentioned that that come up for me. But the other one that I really live by is Mike Nichols. And he said about, with regard to film and theater and storytelling, but it can apply to anything. He said, the only safe thing is to take a chance.
Yeah, that's it.
I think that is so accurate.
It's so true. You just got to take a chance in life, take a chance and also have that faith, that rooted faith that things will just work out. If you make that choice and you go the opposite way of a safe route, know that it's going to happen. It's all going to work out.
And you will fail and you will stumble and you will, be caught off guard, and people will say you made mistakes, and maybe you did, but the thing, and as I say, it's taken me, I wish somebody gave me this pep talk, you know, it's taken me a long time to embrace this, but you know, when I have had a script resoundingly rejected that I thought was great, there's the initial hurt, and then you lick your wounds and you say, all right, let's see if they're right or not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you go into that script or you go into that project and you say, oh my God, I just had an epiphany. They're absolutely right. This character doesn't work at all. You know? So it's about, I think it's about being able to pick yourself off the ground, scrape yourself off the ground, because and go back to get hit in the head again, you know? Because I don't know, I really don't know, there are very few people, I know a few people who have gotten where they are because of connections and money and powerful families and whatever, but most of the people that I know, the filmmakers that I know, the art directors that I know, the costume designers, they come from families that had nothing to do with making entertainment, and they just worked incredibly hard, and they built it up in their mind that nobody was going to stop them from doing this.
Yeah, I mean, it's just hard work, isn't it? Just putting the hours and putting the effort.
There's always going to be various negative forces, whether it's, you know, relatives that are old school and think, you know, just get a job and put some food on the table, and, you know, you're not supposed to be passionate about your work. And, you know, there are newer people that say, but you know, this person's not an actor that you should cast. I mean, they have no profile on social media. And, you know, it's just learning to figure out what to listen, not to listen to.
Yeah, of course. Well, I want to say thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on our podcast of 360 Yourself. If you did like all of the podcasts that we've just done today, which I'm sure you have, sure you will do, because it is incredible what he said. It literally has blown my mind and has inspired me so much. We have all the other episodes on 360 on all listening platforms, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts. So please do check them out. And I want to say, lastly, thank you very much, Ross, for everything.
Well, and Jamie, let me just tell you, I only moved back to New York a couple months ago. And I really love what you're doing with your podcast.
Oh, thank you very much.
I think whatever industry someone is in, it doesn't matter. the things that you're talking about are applicable. And I love the podcast. So thank you. It's an honor to be here.
No worries. Thank you. I also believe that as well. I think everything that we talk about on the podcast is applicable to everyone, everyone in every sort of industry and different situations. So thank you very much.
This is 360 Yourself, and I'm Jamie Neal. Thank you very much for taking a moment to listen to our wonderful guests. Please subscribe to our podcast to access all our brilliant guest episodes. They are released every Sunday at 12 p.m. We are available on all listening platforms, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Overcast, Google Podcasts, and Castro. You can also find us on Instagram at 360_yourself, Twitter at yourself360, and our host at Jamie Neal JN. Thank you for listening.